History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the 1920s, there was a celebrity criminal investigator that the press called the American Sherlock Holmes. His name was Edward Oscar Heinrich, and he pioneered all sorts of forensic techniques used today. Things like forensic geology, looking under a microscope to tell the difference between rock and sand to see where the suspect might have come from, or forensic entomology, knowing how insects interact with a corpse to see how long they might have been dead. He was never a member of the police force, but Heinrich was brought in to consult on a lot of high-profile cases, including the legendary rape and manslaughter trial of the silent era movie star Fatty Arbuckle, and used techniques like bloodstain pattern analysis, ballistics, the use of UV rays to detect blood, hair, and fiber evidence, and handwriting analysis. But most of all, what he did was approach suspects in a different way. In that time period, criminals were thought to be categorically different than other people, and your identity as a criminal defined everything you did and said. Heinrich realized that a criminal had another life, and that informed what they did. So a baker, for example, who committed a murder, would sign his signature in a similar way that he would decorate a cake. Sounds kind of flippant, but it actually led to the successful prosecution of a murderer. Today I'm speaking with Kate Dawson, author of the book American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. And we look at the ways how Heinrich's approach of forensics, of building a case on science and reason, can find a clear way forward in the messy world of crime solving. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Kate Dawson. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott. I appreciate it.
Now, I am very interested in looking at your investigator, and we should probably hash this out. Is it Heinrich or Heinrich?
Thank you for asking. It's Heinrich.
Yes, probably many people stumble over it. And before we dive in, I always like to look at a meta picture. And before he comes along, in general, what does forensics look like?
It's rough. It's a lot of experts who claim to be experts, but they're not, and they're not professionally trained. Heinrich calls them charlatans, which is a little overdramatic, but that's the way he felt because he was professionally trained. He was really the first expert witness in America who had the credentials to back up what he was saying. And so it's been called the Wild West of forensics. There's no certification program for anyone who's claiming to be an expert. There's no Daubert hearings, which is what can happen now if somebody on either side doesn't think an expert can really bring anything relevant to the table. They can call a hearing and the judge will make the decision. None of that happened back then. So Heinrich was very critical of the people who would take the stand and 1 week claim to be a handwriting expert. And then literally a month later, they were talking about ballistics. And he, of course, was thinking, what is going on? You don't know anything about ballistics. So he's very critical at the time.
I'm very curious about the case that allowed you to discover him, where he's looking at two brothers who are train robbers who never actually robbed a train. And you looked at how he was able to glean dozens of clues from just a pair of overalls left behind at the scene. And I think of the Benedict Cumberbatch series, Sherlock, where these visual cues are popping out at his brain. What was that case like, and what was so impressive about him?
Well, this was the case that really gave him the moniker America's Sherlock Holmes. I think because he was able to showcase in this particular case virtually all of the disciplines that he had become an expert in. So in previous cases, you know, he had testified about fingerprinting, forensic geology, entomology, you know, the study of bugs. But this really, the Siskiyou train robbery really pulled it all together. So the story goes that there's actually a trio of brothers who are planning to rob a train. They are not good bank robbers, or I'm sorry, let me restart that. They are not good train robbers. And when they stop the train and, you know, they are trying to rob it, they use too much TNT and blow the whole thing apart. And then they end up killing four people on the train and get away with nothing. And they take off and leave behind not very many clues, any of substance, except for a pair of overalls. And the federal agents who came in looked at the overalls and went over them with what supposedly was a fine-tooth comb and couldn't find any clues. They had a bit of grease on one of the pockets, and that was about it. And so the sheriff became very nervous and asked the federal agents to bring someone else. Oscar Heinrich in the past had worked on behalf of the federal government during World War I. He solved using code. You know, he was a code breaker also, and he solved this really complicated case during World War I. And so they called him in. They sent him the overalls, and he came back with a huge list of clues. You know, he found something in the pockets. That was his use of forensic botany that was, you know, able to tell him what this person did for a living. He was able to talk about the weight and the build of the man who had been wearing the overalls. Again, what he did for a living. And, you know, he was able to build a profile and actually find a piece of paper that had been hidden that indicated who the person was. And so this is the what I call the razzle dazzle of forensics in the 1920s. It made headlines. You know, there were wanted posters out, and you know, these men were on the run for several years before they were caught. But how he did it erased any doubts among juries, around among cops or DAs or defense attorneys that this man knew what he was doing, that he could outthink criminals, that he could outsmart all of the cops around him. And it made him the most demand, the forensic scientist most in demand in the country. It was pretty incredible.
Yeah, and especially since the field didn't exist before. And I'm curious, he solves this case in the 1920s. Before then, how did he educate himself? Because there's not really a field in the same way. How do you practically put together a field, learn it, and then achieve mastery over it when things are still so unformed?
Right. And his background was amazing. So he grew up in Tacoma, Washington. He had kind of a hardscrabble childhood. His family always had financial problems. And that actually was a predictor of what was going to happen to him with things to come. He was always worried about finances. He was much more worried about debt collectors chasing him than being threatened by the criminals that, you know, he testified against in trial. And his father died unexpectedly when he was a teenager, and it put this incredible weight on him, which was something that he also carried throughout his life. He had a financial burden. He had to drop out of school to take care of his mother and his two sisters. And he became a pharmacist when he was 18. He couldn't afford classes, but he read books and he passed the state boards and he became a pharmacist. And that taught him about drugs and toxicology. He talked his way into UC Berkeley without a high school diploma, and he majored in chemistry, but he took biology, trigonometry, all the mathematics, physics. That gave him the scientific foundation that he needed to eventually become a forensic scientist. But he didn't do that immediately. He became a chemical engineer in Tacoma, and he became a sanitation engineer. This taught him about not just chemistry and advancing his knowledge in chemistry, but it also taught him about forensic geology, what makes up a grain of sand or some soil. So all of these skills, you know, pulled together when he came to a crime scene and eventually became a forensic scientist. He had also incidentally been a police chief. And when he was at the pharmacy, what was so interesting is that's where his love of handwriting analysis came from, because he had to decipher the bad handwriting of all of the doctors who were writing prescriptions. So, you know, all of this perfect storm of skills set him up to be this Sherlock Holmes, this generalist who could walk into a shooting scene and not just study ballistics, but look at, you know, were there grains of sand? Were there fibers? Are there handwriting? You know, what are the different disciplines that he could utilize to not just solve the case, but put together a very solid case for, you know, the defense or the prosecution of the suspect?
I love it. It's high tech and low tech. Some of the techniques like handwriting, Francis Walsingham, Queen Elizabeth's spymaster, would have recognized. And I want to get into some of his greatest successes, but I'm interested in the very scandalous case, which was the O.J. Simpson case of its day with Fatty Arbuckle. So could you mention that case, and what did he bring forward there?
So the Fatty Arbuckle case is really interesting. So Fatty Arbuckle, for people who don't know, was the biggest star of his time in the 1920s. He was a silent film star. He was larger than life. He was sort of a buffoon, like a country hick buffoon on screen, but off screen, he had a fantastic personality. He was very, very smart, and he made the most money of any Hollywood star in the 1920s. So in 1921, Labor Day weekend, his friend threw him a massive party at the St. Francis Hotel, which was a very ritzy hotel in San Francisco. And Fatty was celebrating the wrap-up of his latest film. And he had films in the theaters currently that were selling out. And it was pretty incredible. So he had this big party. He had illegal booze because this is during Prohibition. And he had beautiful women surrounding him. And one of the women was an actress named Virginia Rappe. And he and Virginia got along really well. And unfortunately, by the end of the evening, Virginia ended up dead. And the issue was how she died. So there were witnesses that were unreliable there who said that, Fatty Arbuckle was alone in the suite with her and probably they were having sexual relations and he rolled over on her accidentally. He was a very, very large man and killed her. And, eventually he went on trial for manslaughter and for assault. And Oscar Heinrich was the prosecutor's expert witness. And Oscar used fingerprinting evidence, which has always and still many people believe is reliable. And in the book, you'll see photographs that Oscar took of the fingerprints that were left. And his accusation was that he could prove that Fatty Arbuckle and Virginia Rappe were struggling over the door. And in fact, if you look at the cover of my book, that handprint is Fatty Arbuckle's real handprint. It's a photograph that Oscar took. He went to jail, took the, you know, took had him roll the ink, and that's his real handprint. And this was bad evidence. It is now considered junk science. And Fatty Arbuckle's life, not to ruin everything here, but Fatty Arbuckle's life was ruined effectively because of Oscar Heinrich, because he was able to cause a mistrial every single time, essentially, because of this evidence. And the evidence was not good evidence. So for me, Oscar represents the good and the bad of forensics. And I don't think it was malicious necessarily. He really didn't like Hollywood. He didn't like Fatty Arbuckle. But he says that he let the evidence follow him wherever it needed to go. I just don't think he knew that how unreliable fingerprinting could be. And we know that now. And we still can't admit that in court sometimes, that fingerprinting is unreliable. But he was so sure that his techniques were sound that it convinced juries. And in some ways, the results were really discouraging and incorrect, frankly.
And I'd love to hear some of his greatest successes, but beyond kind of describing how he did it, could you walk through his method? When you read Sherlock Holmes, he enters a room. The police investigator might say things. Sherlock is ignoring him. He's sort of building from first principles from the ground up, everything that he gleans and using his vast storehouse of information, making connections no one else does. So could you describe a case and maybe walk through how Heinrich would have pieced together that information?
Sure. Well, I think that the Siskiyou train robbery is a pretty good example of that. So, Heinrich was never really interested in motive. The motive didn't matter all that much to him. I think that he believed, which is the case, that people are killed over the stupidest reasons. And I think it's a little, he felt it was very futile to sort of spin your wheels trying to get into the mind necessarily of a criminal. He would look for clues that would inform him of what the criminal did for a living and what his habits were. So he really believed, which is the truth, that, a criminal is a criminal who also has another life. And that other life creates habits. It's part of your personality. So, a man who was a killer who was also a professional baker, for example, this comes up in another one of his cases. Just because he's a criminal doesn't mean he's not a baker. And a baker has a certain habit. And Oscar knew how to pick up on these habits to inform him a little bit more of a profile of the person. So with the Siskiyou train robbery, he was very methodical, and this was also very unusual. And I think probably his biggest legacy is how methodical he was. So he took the garment, he spent 24 hours on this pair of overalls, and he went from beginning to end, from the top to the bottom, systematically, painstakingly. I can tell you because of his notes, it was actually painstaking for me to read through his notes sometimes. He would take measurements, he would take weights, he would collect them and put them in very special containers. And forensic scientists just didn't do that in this time period. It was a little more haphazard. You know, people tried to save money by putting them in different containers and they wouldn't be labeled. And Oscar really was meticulous. And so he collected things in a really particular way, in a particular order. He would look at fibers first, and then he might look at any botany. So for instance, in the pocket of the overalls, he found fir tree samples. So, you know, he could look under a microscope and he could tell that it was organic material, where it came from, and what part of the country it came from. And he would write that down and he would label it, and then he would save that sample. He would take pictures of it under the microscope. So he was incredibly methodical. It took a long time. He frequently wouldn't sleep. He would gather it all, then he would look at his notes, and he could build the profile and deliver it to the police, who frequently didn't believe him. And he would, I remember reading about a cop from a cop statement one time that said that Heinrich presented him with this photo of a rock. And, you know, the cop said, "What does this rock have to do with this case?" And Heinrich says, "That's not a rock. That's a piece of sand that I magnified, took a photo of it, and then magnified it even more." But you could see how it can be broken up into different sediment, and this is where it came from. And, you know, sand on the East Coast is different than the West Coast. And so all of this is to say that he was so incredibly careful that once he gathered the evidence, he then could take the next step to run tests. So on the rock, he could, you know, on the piece of sand, he could put it under a special microscope that geologists use. It used a prism to sort of break apart the different parts using light. And he could tell where the piece of sand came from. What area, was it close to a stream? You know, if this was a needle, was it a fir tree or was it from a spruce? And so all of those things were 100% based on the evidence that he gathered.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Another high-profile case you mention is finding Father Heslin's killer using handwriting analysis, but not in the more pseudoscientific way others were doing at the time. What was that like?
Well, handwriting analysis then and now is sketchy, just to use a funny term. So there were two types of handwriting analysts in the 1920s. There were the traditional experts like Oscar, and then there were what were called graphologists, whom he hated. So graphologists are the people who can look at your handwriting and say whether you're demented or sane or you have a good sex life, or, I mean, just like a host of silly statements based on your handwriting. What we know now about handwriting analysis is that your handwriting varies, and it varies based on where you're writing at the time, you know, the utensil that you're using, what your feelings are at the time, if you're medicated or not, what your age is. There are variables. It's unreliable. But Oscar used handwriting in the case of Father Heslin, which is at the beginning of the book, in a really unusual way. He looked at the handwriting not to predict whether or not one person, you know, wrote a letter. It was a ransom note. It wasn't to compare the writing of a ransom note with another sample, which is sort of the traditional way to do handwriting, like in a will, in a disputed will, if somebody forged a signature. He could claim that he could predict whether or not the suspect was the one who forged the signature. He used the writing sample, which shocked the police, to be able to say, "Listen, I don't know who did this, but I do know that the profession of this person was a professional baker. He was a baker." And of course, the cops said, "You're crazy." And Oscar just said, "Wait and see." And later on, he would say, "The way that a baker has been trained to write their letters on top of a cake is the way that this man wrote his letters." And that's the point he used to say, that a man's habits or a criminal's habits cannot be broken just because he turns into a criminal, right? A baker is a baker, whether he decides to be a murderer or not. And he can't get out of that habit. No matter how hard you try, you can cover up clues, you can pick up evidence, you could try to outthink the cops, but you can't break your own habits. And that was criminal profiling 50 years before the FBI created its behavioral science unit.
Yeah, before then, would a policeman say, well, there is a criminal mindset and you're somehow other from the rest of the population, and then they're just grouped into that? Is that how they were looking at it?
Right. I mean, in the 1800s, a murderer looks like a murderer. You look deranged, your hair is dirty. If you look like a gentleman, you can't possibly be a murderer. You have the mark of Cain, or, you know, I mean, it's just sort of all sorts of silly subjective statements about what made a criminal. And it's because there was nowhere else to go. How else are you going to predict who a murderer is? You can't. So they're really working on the defense instead of the offense. It's reaction to a crime rather than trying to predict what is going to happen beforehand. And I think Oscar was for sure one of the first in America to profile someone before they were caught. It happened after they were caught, most likely. And it was usually an insanity defense. So they would, you know, you would have a alienist, so a forensic psychiatrist, examine someone after they've been caught and deem whether or not they were sane and could stand trial or insane. But doing it beforehand was very, very unusual. And he really was becoming attuned into those skills.
Why do you think he's not famous? Because if he was something of a celebrity at the time, then how is he still not remembered today?
I don't think we have now those types of forensic scientists. We don't have the Sherlock Holmes types. You have a ballistics expert, you have a toxicologist, you know, everybody is sort of siloed. They have their own expertise. And Oscar was a generalist. And he was also someone, like most forensic scientists, who worked behind the scenes. He generally was not interviewed. It was the cops and the DAs who were, and the defense attorneys who were the ones capturing headlines. And as his career grew, his public profile grew. After he died, you know, his legacy within forensics history was very, very much alive. I mean, forensic scientists now know who he is. But with the general public, forensics moved forward. You know, there was DNA analysis, there was bite mark evidence, there were things that were being developed that captured headlines more easily. And his legacy in the public perception was just sort of lost. He also didn't have a case that was turned into a movie of the week. I mean, if you think about, some people might know who Paul Kirk is, who solved the case of Sam Shepard, you know, the man who went on trial for killing his wife, and it was actually a stranger, and it was turned into a Harrison Ford movie, The Fugitive. It wasn't, you know, like Calvin Goddard, who was the man who solved the St. Valentine's Day massacre, where Al Capone and his gang tried to set up the cops for killing a rival gang. So, you know, these are very high profile cases. He just didn't have that. He had high profile cases at the time, but none that were really sort of turned into this Hollywood movie decades later.
I'm not a huge viewer of crime procedurals, but I know that CSI is omnipotent, still on network television. And I mean, the good thing about that is people are aware of the methods, but then some of the more ridiculous aspects have been turned into memes where the investigator is standing over the computer tech and he says, okay, enhance the image about 15 times.
Right.
And the reflection that is off the screw of a license plate shows you a full reflection of the killer's profile. And so, I mean, that's obviously impossible. Or computer hackers that will use singing animated GIF viruses and all that stuff. But what do you think are techniques that Heimrich left behind that are still valuable to forensics today? And do you think that people kind of have a skewed view of what is and isn't possible based on these shows and how maybe Heinrich can offer something to today to break through that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the CSI effect is very real. And when we say that, it means that juries who watch these procedurals, you know, and CSI and NCIS and anything involving forensics have the expectation when they sit in a real criminal case that the prosecutor or the defense is going to offer this definitive scientific evidence. because they believe scientific evidence is the end all be all. It's frequently not. And that it is definitive and it might not be. So they're expecting the DNA analyst to point to the person in the witness chair and say, this is the man who did it. And that frequently can't happen. And a lot of prosecutors will say they prefer to have a circumstantial case that's very strong. Witnesses and motive and a financial trail and, you know, phone records than one DNA sample. Because a good defense attorney can counter and say, listen, this lab has had problems in the past or other labs have had problems in the past. How do we know this is a good sample? But if you introduce science in the courtroom, juries are apt to believe it. So it's very, very difficult with the amount of junk science that is out there, bloodstain pattern analysis, fingerprinting, things that we think are solid are not on solid footing. And mostly it's because they haven't been peer reviewed. They're not put through the same rigor and research that things like DNA or toxicology are. So I think that the things that are on solid footing that Heinrich explored were things that were on solid footing in traditional science to begin with. Forensic geology, he was the first to introduce it in the United States. So, you know, all you have to do is look under a microscope to see where soil came from, to see where sand came from. Forensic entomology, the way that bugs arrive to a corpse, can tell you when the person died. So blowflies come first, and then beetles come, you know, further down the road. So these are things that are solid, right? Ballistics, he really made headway in ballistics by introducing a technique that allowed you to photograph two bullets at the same time so that you could see the unique markings that a gun makes on each bullet and compare them to a suspect's gun versus the bullet found in a victim. This is all something that is used today. So these are very solid. The squishy things our handwriting analysis, blood stain, pattern analysis, things like that, that he also believed in, fingerprinting.
One other final look at his character, his approach of look at the total person, don't just look at them as a criminal. Has that had a legacy, and do you think that that's something that is still valuable?
Well, I do, absolutely. I think he was absolutely right that someone's behavior, it's hard to break. I mean, think about how hard it would be to stop eating sugar, in my case, or to stop smoking, you know, or to start exercising when you're in a habit and you're a criminal and you're concentrating on cleaning up the crime scene and picking up the, you know, the spent shells and not leaving fingerprints and getting out of there before someone else gets there. I mean, you might not remember that, you know, you work in a mechanic shop and you've got grease and you leave a little grease behind and there's no reason for the grease to have been in this apartment to begin with. And that all kind of builds a profile. So I think, not to feel empathy for criminals, because certainly I don't, but there are a lot of things to think about when you're committing a crime. So yeah, you might forget that you're a baker and that you've, you know, done this type of lettering for years, and now you're not going to think anybody's going to pick up on that. So I do think that there's a lot of validity to, you know, your personality can predict the way you commit a crime. And that was just, and he did not lean too heavily on that. That was just one of the tools that he used.
There's a lot more to unpack there, and if people want to check that out, the book is American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. As always, I'd like to kick things off by thanking the Spymasters for History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Baron Fraza, Chris C., David Santee, The McCrays, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Carl from Norway, Michael from New York, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tyler from Colorado, and Bill Ivy. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.